Welcome to The Lid Is On, our podcast series from UN News here at United Nations headquarters in New York. I'm Deanne Penn.
I got back and went straight to sleep. And I thought, this is really bad. I'm completely exhausted. And this is day one of 40. I've got 39 days of this left.
A woman who doesn't particularly enjoy running has accomplished what many people would consider impossible, completing 40 marathons in 40 days on 6 different continents, running along the banks of 6 of the world's major rivers. Meet Meena Gulli, a lawyer from Australia and founder of a charity called Thirst, which educates young people about the global water crisis and what they can do to change how they use and consume this precious resource. Meena set off on her epic run because she wants to ensure that all people have access to clean water and sanitation, one of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, world leaders are pushing to achieve by 2030. As you can imagine, it was no walk in the park.
So the first day when I had laced up my shoes, I was worried about gear, I was worried about equipment, I was worried about the stories and the people and making sure that I would do this whole thing justice. But I was also completely confronted by my own fragility and thinking, how am I actually going to do this?
The six-week quest saw Meena running along the banks of the Colorado River in the southwestern United States, the Amazon River in Brazil, the Nile in Egypt, the Murray River in her homeland, Australia, the Yangtze River in China, and the River Thames in the United Kingdom. She ran in blistering sun and driving rain, and even when her body felt like it was failing her. I spoke to Meena when she came quite literally hobbling into UN headquarters just 3 days after the final leg of her extraordinary run along the River Thames in London. She began by explaining what that moment was like.
The feeling I had when I crossed the finishing line was almost disbelief. I couldn't believe that this was over, that this part of my journey was done. And at the same time, I knew that actually this is the beginning of the next part, which is almost more important than the running, which is to tell stories about water, to share with people around the world the stories of the people that I met along my journey. I met people all along the way, water experts, people affected by the water crisis, people who had amazing innovations and solutions to water problems that they created. And those are the stories I'm really excited to tell now.
Thanks so much, Meena, and we're going to get to some of those stories later. But I just want to ask you, where did the idea come from to do 40 marathons in 40 days?
So when I was running every single day, I thought to myself, what possessed me to do this? Like, it's the most stupid thing ever. And I'm like, what was I thinking? The reality is I came up with the idea about 40 marathons in 40 days because by 2030 there's going to be a 40% difference between the demand for water and the supply of water available. So I came up with this idea that I wanted to raise awareness about this 40% issue, and I thought, what better way to do it than by running 40 times 40, which is 40 marathons. And I thought, well, why not do it in 40 days? When I told people that this was what I was going to do, everybody said to me, is that even possible? And I hadn't even thought if it was possible or not, because I just thought, you know, if we start to create limits based on our assumptions of what is and isn't possible without trying, then we'll never solve any global problems because it will all seem too big and too challenging.
And now you're a lawyer, but you're also an ultra runner. So running is something that you enjoy?
Okay, so this is going to make me sound like a completely crazy lunatic, but I don't actually like running. My enjoyment of running, somebody asked me yesterday, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you enjoy running? I'm like, okay, so 10 is the most and 1 is the least, right? And they go, yes, yes, yes. I said 1, below 1. I don't think of myself as an ultra runner. I don't think of myself as a runner at all. I'm just a person who decided that they want to make a difference on this planet. And the way I chose to do it is using my feet to go and go to places and see things for myself and speak to people and understand these issues at a very grassroots level. And I literally ran like crazy distance, which even today I find it hard to believe that I did that.
It's starting to sink in.
You know, it's one of those things that I don't think it's going to sink in for a long time. because it still seems so surreal, and because the only way I could get through it in many ways was to suspend my cognizance of what my body was doing and just focus on the water issues that I was seeing around me all day, every day. So I remember vividly the water aspects of what I was doing. I have completely forgotten and obliterated from my brain the pain that I went through.
Really? Wow. Okay, then. So let's go back to day one. You lace up your shoes, and it's in Colorado. Tell us about that first day.
The first day was a bit scary for me because it was an absolute reality check. So I went into this knowing that in that 40 days, I had to run 40 marathons, I had to take over 20 flights, and I had to travel to 6 continents, which meant that I had to run more than a marathon a day. So I was running about 30, 35 miles many of the days. So the first day when I got out and ran, I was honestly really scared because up until a month beforehand I'd been injured and I hadn't run more than 15 minutes. And on day one I knew I had to get to 50 to 55 kilometres. That's a lot of distance to have to cover. So the first day when I had laced up my shoes, I was worried about gear, I was worried about equipment, I was worried about the stories and the people and making sure that I would do this whole thing justice. But I was also completely confronted by my own fragility and thinking, how am I actually going to do this? And at the end of the day, when I sat there and thought, wow, I got back and went straight to sleep. And I thought, this is really bad. I'm completely exhausted. And this is day one of 40. I've got 39 days of this left. And I thought, the only way I'm going to go through this is by continuing to believe in what I'm doing. Every day to take that SDG 6 flag out and look at it. Every day to meet new people and remind myself that this is an issue far bigger than me, far bigger than my pain, and far, far bigger than my fear of my own limitations.
Now, you just mentioned the SDG flag with goal 6. That's the goal for clean water and sanitation. Tell us about the flag. What was that for?
I wanted to have something that coalesced people around the issue of water. And I was very concerned that people didn't seem to be very aware that the SDGs even existed, let alone my favourite one. And so I decided that I would take this SDG flag as a very visual way of showing people and getting people to understand that this was what it was, because the image of the flag transcends cultures, transcends ability to read, transcends basically language barriers. So I took two flags. One was big enough for me to hold and for me to hold with other people, and the other one was big enough for people to sign from all over the world. It's literally enormous. It's about 4 metres by 4 metres. That's huge. Anytime I put it down on a pavement or on a table or opened it up anywhere, people came first inquisitive. When they understood what it was, they not only signed it themselves, but it was amazing to see how many would go and get other people and recruit others to also sign the flag. And the same thing happened when I took the flag out to take photos, whether it was with people on a floating house on the Amazon River who couldn't speak English and couldn't write and couldn't read, but they, when they understood about what I was doing, immediately asked if they could take a photo with the flag. Whether it was farmers in the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia who were so happy that I was showcasing there and talking about their issues and wanted to have a picture with the flag. These people are really positive about having their voice heard, determined to do something, and the flag enables them to, in a very visual way, do that.
And now you mentioned you had to run actually more than a marathon every day. What was the typical day like?
It depended on the day. So every day I get up at 5. I still wake up at 5, and part of me goes, quick, get out there, go running. I get up at 5, 5:30, head out. So I need to pack all my gear up. We usually move every day.
Sorry, you mentioned we. You was you and...
So I'm the runner. I'm the only dummy that goes out in 45 degrees in Egypt and goes running. And I have an amazing support team. I'm a firm believer in saying that you can't achieve big things without the support of other people. So I have a team of people that come. I had a photographer and a videographer, as well as someone to handle social media. Those three people allow me to do something that other people can participate in without being there. So we take pictures to show people what it's like. We take videos so that even if people can't come and do something dumb like running like I did, most people, sane people, wouldn't want to do that. So, but I really want people to feel what it's like. I want people to experience it, to be there beside me. And I know that they are there. Like every step I take, I feel like I have a community of people around me. But allowing people to see that and feel that through video and visual is really important. And then depending on the river, I have one or two other team members who are medical. So I always try to have one medical person with us who can do surgery on the run, literally. We did some foot surgery on a boat in the Amazon, much to the amazement of the local community. Just like, you've got a scalpel on this boat in the Amazon? What is wrong with you people? And then they looked at us and went, oh, foreigners, and shook their heads. We did some surgery on a train in Egypt. This time I needed a lot of medical help because, as I said, I was much less prepared. My body was breaking down. I'm not young, so, you know, I'm 46 years old. I think at some point, you know, your body just starts to go, ouch. And unfortunately for me, it was the last 6 weeks.
What kind of injuries, I mean, that you had? I mean, where they actually had to come in with a scalpel and fix you.
Yeah, so I had some toe problems. My toenails were quite badly injured. In the Amazon, it was very wet. It's a rainforest, so it's not unexpected. But some of the trails that we were running on were really muddy and clay, and that meant my feet were sliding around. I really felt like I was skating on ice. And at times there were 2 or 3 inches of mud that were attached to the bottom of my shoe, which meant it was like running with high-heeled shoes. Guys wouldn't understand, but most women who are listening will get it instantly. Imagine running a marathon with high-heeled shoes on. It was hard. And because of that, I caused myself a lot of damage, not only to my toes, but also to my hips and my calf muscles, which meant, and of course, there's no recovery time, right? So it's not like I can just go, look, I'm a bit injured, I need a day off. I had to keep on going. So in the Amazon, the day after I damaged a lot of my toes, we had to excavate my toenails.
Okay, I'm moving away from the mic because I'm like cringing. I'm,
yeah,
like,
I hope nobody's eating at the moment. Yeah, we had to excavate some of my toenails and toes, just leave, like, okay, it was really gross, just pretty gross. And we had a lot of work to do to try to get my muscles to be fixed. So we used needles. The first time we used the needles, I thought, oh, it's just going in a little bit of the way. These needles go in like 2 to 2.5 inches into your muscles. It is amazing how it works, how these things work to relax your muscles and to rehabilitate. So, you know, it's a lot of surgery on the go. It's a lot of fixing things as you can. And the rest of it's just me having grit and determination and resilience to work through the pain. And the pain is, I guess, the worst thing. To get a sense of it, I was really determined. I didn't want to tell people that I was in pain. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to show people how hard it really was. I wanted people to think it was all cruisy. My team insisted that I tell the backstory. So there is a video online on my Facebook page and also on my website that shows how I felt and how I really dealt with the pain and how severe it was every single day. And I do think it's important that people understand that achieving big goals isn't just about the good times, it's also about getting through the bad times. That sometimes you think that the world is against you, sometimes you think that the hurdles you have to jump are far beyond what you can manage. But if you concentrate on putting one foot in front of the other, it doesn't matter how fast you go, just keep on moving forward, and you concentrate on the ultimate goal that you're committed to achieving and the passion that you have for it, you can achieve anything.
But there must have been days when you said, you know, what the heck am I doing? I have to stop. What kept you going forward?
I have a driving desire to achieve the targets of SDG 6 by 2030. Last year I ran across 7 deserts on 7 continents in 7 weeks. And one of the deserts was a desert called the Richtersveld Desert, which sits between South Africa and Namibia. There's a river that divides the desert. It's called the Orange River. And I stood on the banks of that Orange River looking across and talking to some of the local people, and they said, Mina, you need to understand this river has gone down 7 meters in 7 years. And when I asked them why, they said, when you run over the other side of the river, you will see. And I ran up the other side through acre after acre of bright green grape plantations, smack bang in the middle of the desert. And what's happened is that agriculture has, in an unfettered, unrestricted way, been draining the water of the Orange River. And I stood there on that day and I said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I am going to dedicate my life to solving the water crisis. And so on those days when I thought I couldn't go on, I thought about water and thought about the next generation, and I thought about the world that I want to leave for those kids. And it's a world where there's enough water for everyone forever. Not only clean water, but sufficient water. It's a world where we use water sustainably in our supply chains. It's a world where we don't pollute our rivers and waterways. It's a world where we manage our river basins properly to make sure that there is enough water for the future. And it's a world where we know that with enough water, our kids can achieve whatever dreams they set out for themselves.
You spoke about the Orange River in southern Africa and now the six rivers that you traveled along. Did you also have similar experiences, for example, local people pointing out how the rivers have changed?
Yeah, every single day I found people that would tell me stories, whether they were water experts or farmers or just people along the way that had lived on the rivers. I think there are a couple of things that really struck me. The first is that it's running along a river is a very visceral way of seeing that water is life. In a place like the Nile, where we're running along the banks of the river, if you stray too far from the river bank, instantly you're in the desert. So if you take a shot from above the Nile, you can see a band that is a bright green band that runs through Egypt, in this case, as I was running in Egypt. It's bright green, and outside that, it's absolute brown desert. In the Amazon, where the people live in floating houses tethered to the banks of the Amazon River and can tell you instantly whether the river is going up or down, can tell you how the river works, treat the river as if it is a living, breathing organism. Or in the Thames, where people also live, but live in boats, in these big barges that plough the thousands of kilometres of canals that are like roadways in the UK that you don't even think about, you don't even see it. You just think a road is a tarmac piece that a car drives on. But actually, in a place like the Yangtze, where roads are one thing, but the rivers also carry huge amounts of transport, and the rivers are also used to generate power, whether it's the Hoover Dam in Colorado, whether it's the Three Gorges Dam in a place like China, where the rivers have been used to power and support millions and millions of people, not only in those local areas, but also outside the areas. I think that those are the kind of big generic issues which I saw, but there are also the characters, the people that I met along the way, that show me at a very grassroots level just how critical water is to their lives.
Can you tell us about one or two of them?
Yeah, so I met a woman in Australia called Kristen. She's a third-generation farmer. I liked her instantly. Expect a farmer that you meet to be, male and kind of, I hate to say stereotyping, but it's true, right? So I met Kristen. She's strong and just determined to make the farm a success. Kristen uses water from the Murray River. The Murray River provides water for the vast majority of Australia's agriculture. It runs through multiple states. The Murray was drying up. It was in a terrible state. And the Australian government restructured their management of the Murray River so that all the states that the river ran through got together and actually figured out how they were going to manage it and created a system of trading water rights. Kristen, as a farmer, buys and sells water rights to support her farm. The Murray River supplies farmers like Kristen through a series of 3,000 kilometres worth of canal that stretches across the southern part of Australia and enables those farmers to use that water, whether it's dry or not dry, they can get access to this water that sustains their farms and their farmlands. Kristen's second biggest cost on her farm is water. So she is extremely aware of the levels of water in the river. She's extremely aware of how much water she's using and uses all kinds of innovation to make sure that she reduces her water consumption. And interestingly, she is just one of many farmers in that area doing the same thing. So I looked at her and I just thought, it's amazing how you can create a change in attitude. You can put a value on water just by people understanding how scarce it is. I think in places like America where you turn on the tap and water comes out, you forget that actually you have a supply chain. So when you go in America to buy Australian beef, you forget that that beef was grown in a place, maybe it was even Kristen's farm, where water is a big issue, it's carefully managed, and it is a really valuable resource. And we forget how much water goes into our products. When I tell people eating a hamburger is the same as taking a two-hour shower, they're honestly completely flawed. But that is our global supply chains.
You, of course, were conscious of these issues before your run, your many, many runs, not to belittle them. What would you say you've learned, or something that's surprised you or that's shown you a new perspective?
I mean, every day I got surprised by water facts. I climbed a tree in the Amazon River, a 250-year-old tree, meters and meters off the ground. I was desperately afraid, crying my little heart out. I felt like a baby. But anyway, I got up there.
Why did you climb such a big tree?
Yeah. I climbed the tree because I had heard that in Sao Paulo in 2015, the city ran out of water for a number of days.
Yes, I was there.
It was a dire situation. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, how does a city run out of water? Doesn't it rain here? Like, drought? What's going on? So when I was in the Amazon, I asked one of the water experts, and he said, aha, come with me. So we traversed the Amazon rainforest in a boat to go to one of the places you can't access by road. We climbed this tree. He said, I want you to see for yourself what is happening. So I went up and we sat on the branches, and he said, look above you. And I could see small wisps of what looked like smoke coming off the trees. It looked like the trees were on fire. And I looked up and I said, what is that? And he goes, the trees are transpiring. The trees give off water vapor into the atmosphere. That water vapor comes together in a cloud, and then it gets blown down to the southern part of Brazil, as they're called flying rivers. And these flying rivers have been the source of a lot of rainfall for a lot of Brazil. And what's happened with deforestation is that these flying rivers are slowly drying up, and so there's less rainfall, and places like Sao Paulo are starting to run out of water. That was one of those moments where you sit there and you think, you know, this is an aspect of deforestation I never realized. It's a, you know, yet another one of the SDGs, but you don't think about how some of these SDGs relate to each other. Some are obvious, sustainable consumption of water, partnerships in water, but when you think about things like deforestation, you don't instantly think it has an impact on water, and yet it does. This is just an example of one of the many things that surprised me during the 6 weeks. I think the thing that really struck me more than anything else in terms of a surprise was the power of one person to make a difference. So when I started this, it was me running. By the end of the first week, I had kids running with me. By the end of the second week, I had families and members of the public I didn't even know running with me. By the end of the third week, I had hundreds and then thousands of kids running with me. So what I realized through this process, and the whole thing snowballed, was that sometimes we think that we are nobody. But actually, you don't have to be anyone to be someone. Every single one of us can make a difference. And sometimes we forget that. And I think that one of the things that I hadn't really thought about, but that did happen over those 6 weeks, is that just by me doing this thing showed people the art of the impossible, that we don't need to set limits, that we can achieve our dreams, no matter how crazy they are, that every one of us has the power to make change. When we understand that, and when we understand that we're all capable of change and creating a better planet, that we will make a better planet.
And now, Mina, why did you come to the UN today?
I came here because I feel incredibly humble and indebted to all the people that I met along the way who have given me their stories, who have shared their stories, to tell them. And I want people to understand what I've seen, to learn and experience what I've learned and experienced. And for me, the best place to do that is the United Nations. You are the custodians of the SDGs. It is the UN who set those SDGs. It's the members of the United Nations who have the ability to help to achieve those SDGs. It's here that is the center of the work that needs to be done. And it was very important to me that I take those voices of the people that I've met, whether it's having signed the flag or the stories that I have to tell, and share those with the people here in headquarters and enable all of us to have participated in that journey. Because unless we all work together to achieve these goals, and specifically achieve SDG 6 in my view, because it also transcends so many of the other SDGs, but unless we work together, we will fail. And failure, especially for water, is not an option.
That was Mina Gulley recounting how she ran 40 marathons in 40 days along six rivers in six continents to raise awareness about the need for clean water and sanitation, or as we officially refer to it around here, Sustainable Development Goal 6. And yes, Mina doesn't intend to stop running anytime soon. She plans to lace up her running shoes next year to draw attention to supply chain routes and their role in globalization. And with that, we come to the end of this latest edition of The Lid Is On, our podcast series at United Nations Headquarters. I'm Deanne Penn. Thanks for joining us.